Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano, who is on our second base over in Charlottesville, Virginia. How are things in Charlottesville, Frank?
Everything in Charlottesville is great, David. It's actually Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day, depending on your perspective.
Thanksgiving for our Canadian listeners.
I was about to say that. Happy Thanksgiving to our Canadian friends. So it's a quasi holiday here. Well, south of the border in Canada, it is a holiday. And so, yeah, everything's great here.
And does Charlottesville recognize Columbus Day or not?
Well, I'll tell you that Monticello doesn't, because we're open for business here at the International Center for Jefferson Studies.
Okay.
But I don't. It's hard for me to tell.
Okay.
When I was in my apartment building this morning, there seemed to be a few more cars in the parking lot this morning of people who seem to have the day off. But for a lot of people, it seemed to be just another day. Columbus Day's always been a weird holiday.
Oh, to be sure. Do you know when Columbus Day originated?
It originates in New York in the early 20th century. It becomes a federal holiday, I think, in 1934 or around then.
Yeah, but the president declares it in 1892 as the first presidential declaration of Columbus Day.
Oh, right, for the 400th anniversary.
So it's an interesting weird holiday or something.
Well, it's a weird holiday because, of course, it's a political sop to Italian Americans as well. In fact, President Trump just issued, I saw on Twitter, a proclamation. Well, you can just issue it. He issued it a couple of days, but the White House circulated it this morning, you know, proclaiming today Columbus Day and talking about Columbus as a brave explorer and all this kind of stuff. And it's clearly an effort to, you know, troll the libs, as they like to do, and upset people, because it's a version of Columbus Day straight from the kind of 1890s rather than the 21st century.
All right, so happy Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day or Thanksgiving as one celebrates or not.
Or Monday if you're David.
Yes, or Monday where I have class and all kinds of things. Yes, here in the UK. So there's two stories we want to talk about today. One is we want to sort of come to grips with the Kavanaugh hearings and confirmation vote and what that means and what that portends for the future of the Supreme Court. And the second thing we'd like to talk about today is a very lengthy, I think it's 14,000-word New York Times article that looks at Donald Trump and Donald Trump's father's financial entanglements and the ways in which the Trump family seemed to be, if not bending inheritance tax law, outright breaking it. Frank, I know you read widely in all kinds of sources, but I'm not sure whether you're a regular Dan Savage reader or even know who he is. I'm going to pretend you don't know who he is. But he is a sex columnist out of Seattle who also has become something of a political commentator as of late. And he made the argument recently, I'm curious what you think about this, that liberals should not worry so much about Kavanaugh getting confirmed, because as soon as this big blue wave happens, he's going to be impeached and we can get a better Supreme Court as a consequence. What do you think about the merits of that argument?
I would give kind of two cheers for it, in the sense that I think it has some merit in that if Donald Trump operated like I would say a normal president, but if he had acted like previous presidents, when the Kavanaugh stuff came to light, they would have forced him to the Trump administration would have forced Kavanaugh to withdraw his candidacy and nominated somebody else, somebody with similar or possibly even more conservative views, but who was less controversial. They didn't do that, and they didn't do that for a lot of reasons. I think we don't need to rehearse those necessarily. So I think Savage is right in the sense that if it had been somebody else from the Federalist Society list, we'd end up with the same configuration on the court without any possibility of impeachment. Having said that, I think it's possible that Kavanaugh will be impeached, and by impeachment I mean, you know, impeachment is a two-step process. We've talked about this before on the pod. There's the kind of indictment that comes from the House of Representatives, and then there's the trial by the Senate. And the process of impeachment is the same for Supreme Court justices that it is for the president. And I think we'd end up in a situation – I think we could. In fact, I think it's entirely possible we end up in a situation where the House of Representatives adopts House of Representatives dominated by the Democrats, assuming the Democrats win the House next month, adopt articles of impeachment against Judge Kavanaugh, but that the Senate does not remove him from office, because again, it would require 67 senators to remove him from office, two-thirds, and we don't know how the Senate's going to go next month, but certainly the Democrats aren't going to control two-thirds of the Senate. So I think we would end up with a weakened Kavanaugh as a result of this. So I guess I'd qualify slightly Dan Savage's interpretation. What do you think?
Well, so I mean, there's a couple of things that strike me. One, we don't have any examples of Supreme Court justices actually being removed from office, right? We've got a couple of people who have, you know, people have talked about impeachment. We can talk about those handful of examples, but we've never actually, this mechanism has never actually been used either for removing a president or for removing a Supreme Court justice. It has been for lower court justices, but not for Supreme Court justices. And, you know, one of the effects that the impeachment process has had on presidents, whether it's, you know, Andrew Johnson or Bill Clinton, and you can sort of put Nixon aside, but in some ways it, after their impeachment trial, they kind of sat on their hands until they were out of office, because it sort of, it weakened them politically. With a Supreme Court justice, though, of course, there's no election that's going to put them out of office. They're going to be there until they decide not to be there, or until, you know, Mother Nature tells them they're no longer going to be there. And so, you know, the weakening effect on Kavanaugh, I'm not sure that's actually what happened. You know, they're not as dependent upon political will to, you know, enact their judicial agenda, whatever that happens to be. And so I think, you know, were he to be impeached, he might be humbled by that, and he might rein back his more, you know, radical tendencies in terms of his judicial philosophy. But you could also have the opposite effect, where if he doesn't get removed from office, which, as you point out, the odds of that are about zero, actually might actually embolden him to be less cooperative with more moderate justices on certain divisive issues.
Yes, humility is not a characteristic or a quality I would associate with now Justice Kavanaugh, to be sure.
At least if the, you know, the hearings, the Senate hearings, are any indication, that doesn't seem to be his strong suit. So we do have a couple of examples of justices that people have talked about removing from office. One fairly early on in the court. Do you want to talk about Samuel Chase?
Yeah, Samuel Chase was one of the first Supreme Court justices, or certainly one of the earliest, and he was appointed by George Washington. He was a high Federalist. He was very, very conservative in his jurisprudence by the standards of the day. President Jefferson was greatly annoyed by Chase. Jefferson was annoyed by what he saw as a Federalist attempt, particularly by Washington's successor, John Adams, to control the judiciary. And basically, you know, the Federalists recognized, like the Republicans do today, that judges are for life, and paid a lot of attention to the judiciary. And Jefferson sought to – and so John Adams, after he lost the election of 1800, made a number of what were called midnight appointments to the court. Chase was not one of them, or to the federal courts. And this greatly aggrieved Jefferson. Anyway, we cast our minds forward, we go forward a couple of years to 1803-4, and at that point there's an effort to impeach Chase in the – and again, remember, this is a two-step process. So Chase is impeached in the sense that the House of Representatives adopts articles of impeachment. basically around his conduct on the bench. And there were two main criticisms of Chase. One was that he was – well, one was he was overly partisan on the court. The second was that he drank too much. And which echoes of Kavanaugh, really. Mm. But in the end, he was not removed from office because it was impossible to muster two-thirds of two-thirds of the Senate to remove him from office. So I think that's similar to what may happen to Kavanaugh if the Democrats go down the impeachment route. I think more likely, though, and if I can kind of think about Kavanaugh in this sense, is I think he may be in legal jeopardy.
Hmm.
We could be in unprecedented territory here because I think that the investigations into Kavanaugh, I think the FBI investigation last week was a joke, but I think the investigations are going to continue on the part of journalists like Ronan Farrow at The New Yorker. And I think it's possible that more stuff could come out, some of which might place him in legal jeopardy, which could change the equation.
Now, the interesting thing about that is even if, let's imagine hypothetically, he were to get arrested and go on trial and get convicted, that doesn't actually remove him from office. He would still, and we have cases like of federal judges where this has happened, where they have been criminally convicted of something, but because they haven't been removed from office through the only process we have for removing judges from office, they still held their, held on to their robes. So that would be a very weird situation on top of all the other weird situations we've got.
Yeah, not least because we could face a situation where the president, and we'll get to this when we talk about the New York Times piece, might be in some sort of legal jeopardy and Kavanaugh will have to pass judgment on him, which indeed was one of the reasons it's supposed that President Trump stuck with Kavanaugh rather than find just another one from the list.
To be sure, among other reasons, yes. The other sort of big example that comes to mind when people talk about judicial impeachment was the movement to impeach Earl Warren in the 1950s and 1960s. And this never actually amounted to Congress taking any action. But Earl Warren, who was appointed Chief Justice under President Eisenhower when Fred Vinson died in 1953, Eisenhower picked Earl Warren in part because he was a moderate Republican. He thought he could work with the rest of the court, most of which was liberal Democrats at that point, appointed under FDR. But Warren turned out to be more liberal than many people anticipated and is on the court for the Brown versus Board of Education decision, and a number of Baker versus Carr and Reynolds versus Sim and Gideon versus Wainwright and all these other kinds of Miranda versus Arizona, all those kinds of cases. And there was a movement throughout the 50s and 60s to impeach Earl Warren. In fact, you would have seen in certain parts of the country billboards in people's yards, flyers and whatnot, saying impeach Earl Warren. A lot of this was backed by the John Birch Society, which was a conservative think tank, if you will. But those are, I think, are really the only examples we have of, serious political movements to remove a Supreme Court justice. And we can think of lots of other cases where justices make bad decisions that are politically unpopular, but that don't prompt that level of political response to talk about impeachment.
It will be interesting, I think, to see how the court responds collectively to him, because although there is now a clear conservative majority, the members of the Supreme Court take the court as an institution very seriously, unsurprisingly. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, for example, is fairly conservative but does care about the reputation of the court. And Kavanaugh's overt partisanship and, frankly, the way he was forced onto the court by the Republican majority in the Senate, the very slim majority, basically because they could. There's a bit of a stain associated with him or a stink associated with him. And I wonder how the other four conservative justices in particular are going to deal with that. Because Supreme Court justices do care about the reputation of the court.
I would agree. I think Roberts is actually going to become more important. He's already the Chief Justice, but I think if you can become more important, I think his role is going to be even more important in the coming years, in large part because Roberts, even though he's a conservative, seems to be not as ideological as the other four conservative justices, and most notably voted in favor of Obamacare in that particular case. And so he's not a swing vote really, but if there is a swing vote on the court, it may actually be the Chief Justice. So I think there's a chance his role may be the Anthony Kennedy, if you will, in sort of the next round of cases.
I agree, but that's testimony to how far to the right the court has shifted,
Yeah,
that
oh,
he's
to be
now in the
sure.
center.
Oh, no, yeah, Jeff, John Roberts is your, yeah, then he's, at least in my reading, a very conservative judge. And so the ideological divisions on the court are as stark as they ever have been. What do you think are the likely big decisions on, if we're going to sort of imagine what this means for the future of the court? What do you think
Oh.
the Kavanaugh appointment and now confirmation is going to mean for the kinds of decisions the court's going to hand down?
I think there are, well, first of all, they're going to be much more conservative. You and I have discussed this in the past. To some extent, Republicans, particularly conservative Republicans, have paid attention to the judiciary much more consistently and for much longer than Democrats have, and this is the culmination of a 40-year process. So, but I think there are three main areas that will come to the fore, perhaps sooner rather than later. One, which is kind of unique to the Trump administration, will be how the court deals with the legal problems that are coming down the pike for Donald Trump. I think it's a reasonable expectation that the Democrats will win back the House in a month's time, and I think if they do so, there will be loads of investigations launched about the various criminal activities associated with the Trump administration, and subpoenas will be issued, and so on and so forth. How the court is going to adjudicate those is going to be very, very important. Second, I think the court will have to deal with the issue of gerrymandering and the various cases regarding the right to vote and voter suppression. And I think a conservative majority is worrying in that sense. And third, and most perhaps most consequential for the long term, is about Roe versus Wade. And the question is whether they will kind of overturn Roe v. Wade or simply acquiesce in the kind of long-term process that's been ongoing of effectively nullifying it by gutting it at the state level and going along with that. I think overturning it is of such symbolic importance, though, to particularly evangelical, conservative evangelical Christians, that they may well do it. I think and that would be a huge decision. What do you think?
I would agree with all of that. I think the one of the things the court I think has done over this past two sessions is they've actually put off dealing with very big cases, both when they had the Scalia seat empty and now, prior to this case, they've in choosing which course cases they're going to review, they've actually put off these huge issues. I think so. This current session of the Supreme Court, which just started a couple, I guess, last week, will not be the one that culminates in the sort of tidal waves of major decisions. But the year after that, I imagine we're going to get some very monumental decisions being handed down by this court, because I think there's been they've been holding back the door, and then it's just all going to come flooding through, I think. Yeah, we will see what happens. The other sort of thing that struck me about the sort of the whole confirmation process is they had the Judiciary Committee hearings. They had this week-long fake investigation by the FBI, and I think anybody who looks at it, or not everybody, the half of us who look at it from the left see that investigation is kind of a sham. What was striking to me about that whole process in retrospect is that nobody's opinions actually changed from the moment Kavanaugh was nominated until the moment he was confirmed. That the people who are in favor of him only strengthened their support for him despite all the weirdness of his confirmation hearings and this FBI investigation, all kinds of things. Those people who were against him were only more against him after all this. And I think that was it says something about the status of American politics and the polarization that a very unorthodox confirmation process had people retreat to their political corners in ways that I find, well, I mean, lots of politics right now I find very disturbing, but I think the fact that people didn't analyze the evidence independently of their political backgrounds I found disturbing. I'm not quite sure what that means for the future, but it looks like the polarization that we've been seeing has only been exacerbated by all of this. In as much as Republicans look at Kavanaugh and see him as a man who was mistreated by Democrats and had character assassination, and Democrats conclude that he most likely committed sexual assault and has no business being on the Supreme Court. And I think that bifurcation of reality is, I think, dangerous for a democracy.
Well, I agree, and it reflects the kind of bifurcation in the media and the fact that, you know, this fake news trope has been incredibly powerful, and it's worked. I mean, I think that the people who support Justice Kavanaugh supported his elevation to the court simply don't believe the allegations against him, and if they go on to Fox News or Breitbart or what have you, they will, you know, there are conspiracy theories out there, and about, and I think Donald Trump this morning called it a hoax.
Yeah,
having a week ago said she was very compelling, and I think that I think that Americans are divided, and they see the world in two very, very different ways. And those perspectives, there's no common ground between those perspectives anymore.
Yeah, and so thinking about the Senate as a debating, you know, deliberative body where they're supposed to persuade each other of things, I think that's kind of out the window. I think there's no persuasion going on really if no one is willing to sort of step outside of their corner.
Well, Mitch McConnell has broken the Senate. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
I would tend to agree, as the rules that they and it's, you know, it's not him alone. I think it's a larger political process that's happened, but he's definitely been a key player in all that. All right, enough about Kavanaugh, at least for now. We'll see what the future portends for that. So let's talk about this New York Times article, this very lengthy 14,000 word piece that examines in great detail the Trump family fortune and the ways in which Fred Trump passed on his millions to his children, in particular to his son Donald, who is now president. Frank, for those people who haven't had a chance to read this article, and if you haven't read the article, pause the podcast right now, go read the article, come back.
Next week when you're finished.
Yes, it's the Times very wisely, I think, has actually produced the article in like three different formats. They've got the 14,000 word version. They've got like a condensed version for those people who don't have time or interest to read the 14,000 word version. And I think they have a video too, so you can digest it in a variety of different forms. But for those people who are not going to do any of that, what were the highlights to you, Frank, of this piece?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it is a testimony and a monument to the importance of traditional journalism, because I can't think of another media entity that could undertake such an investigation. I mean, I think they read 100,000 documents and give it the space and scope that the New York Times did. So, you know, newspapers still matter, even if we don't read them as physical newspapers anymore. other things, the kind of takeaways, first of all, I would say, to use a kind of Scottish expression, Fred Trump was a hard bastard. I mean, he was a seriously tough character. And then some of the facts that are that jump out are just extraordinary. That Donald Trump was making $200,000 a year as a 3-year-old, and had made his first million. Advisedly here. And certainly didn't earn it when he was 8. I talked to my son yesterday, who's back in Edinburgh. He said, "Well, you hear what Donald Trump's dad gave him. What have you given me?"
You gave him an education and a worldview, Frank.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you, David. But I think he'd rather have $200,000 a year as a 3-year-old. But it's the other thing that's striking and really comes across, and I would commend people read the whole thing, is the degree of deliberate planning that went into tax evasion. And indeed, the New York Times uses the word fraud, and they use the word fraud deliberately, and I'm sure they consulted their lawyers before so doing. The amount of kind of planning that went into the Trumps evading paying taxes, and in some cases, it seems quite compelling, and I'm not a tax lawyer, breaking the law in order to avoid paying taxes. So in that sense, it's a blockbuster. What's striking about our times is this appeared last Tuesday, so nearly a week ago. It appeared amidst the Kavanaugh imbroglio, and it hasn't been forgotten, but it did not make this is the kind of journalism that would have brought down and may still bring down President Trump, but would bring down a presidency almost immediately. What was your takeaway, David?
Well, so one of the things about Trump's whole political career that it's always been very striking to me is Trump tries to portray himself as a man of the people. All throughout the campaign, he situated himself as a populist who understood the plight of working people, which doesn't make any sense because he lives in a golden tower, like a literal golden tower, and has mansions throughout the world and on, millions, if not billions, of dollars. And he's tried to spin this narrative of being a self-made man, that, he said at various points in time that his father gave him a loan of $1 million that he had to repay with interest, and that the vast wealth that he had was largely a product of his own genius and talent. What the Times piece, I think, does very well is demonstrate that that's a lie. But Trump, I think, was trying very much in creating narratives like that to appeal to a certain trope in American discourse about coming from the people to being coming into power, and one that has very, the whole American dream of anybody can make it. And it's a kind of lie that in some ways has some precedence. I mean, the one that jumps out to me is William Henry Harrison, the obvious one, of course.
Why is that obvious, David?
Well, you're supposed to laugh at that because William Henry Harrison isn't obvious for
anything. Oh, sorry.
my repository of William Henry Harrison punchlines is very short, Frank, so I've got to work with what I got. William Henry Harrison ran for president claiming that he grew up in a log cabin, which is an outright lie. He grew up on a Virginia plantation made out of bricks, and had his family had included, governors of Virginia and signers of the Declaration, and all, that he comes from a politically elite family with lots and lots of money. And, he runs for president. He makes this claim about growing up in a log cabin, none of which is true. But I think it's that same kind of trope that Trump is playing on, that Americans, I think, are, from their very beginning, I think, uncomfortable with inherited wealth. They're uncomfortable with this idea of aristocracy. But on the other hand, we have a very deep political tradition going back, you know, to the founding generation of rewarding not actual aristocrats, but sort of financial aristocrats with political power over and over again. And I think that's quite striking.
Yeah, I mean, I qualify that slightly, and your comment about them not being actual aristocrats is important. I think. I don't think Americans are as uncomfortable with inherited wealth as you do. Mm. I do think they're uncomfortable with aristocracy in the sense of formal. You know, there's always been this ambivalence in the United States about actual aristocracy.
Mm.
So in terms of inherited titles and, you know, landed folks from Europe with inherited titles, there's a fascination with such people. And I refer listeners to our earlier episode on the royal wedding. And my views on that are well established. So there's always been a fascination, and there's a long tradition, especially in the Victorian era, of wealthy Americans, so often wealthier than their European counterparts, going to Europe and usually women, heiresses, and marrying European aristocrats. And that's
sometimes sometimes European aristocrats who have titles but no actual wealth anymore.
Right. That's right. So
Downton Abbey, for instance, is
the, yeah, well, I don't watch. I've never seen Downton Abbey. Sorry. I wouldn't waste my time. We're going to talk about my Netflix viewing habits later in the episode, as you know. Yeah. But as a cultural type, that's quite powerful, and there's a kind of anti-aristocratic tendency in American politics that manifests itself in William Henry Harrison, but also people like Jefferson and Washington, or later the Roosevelts. These are people who, by many standards, would be aristocratic, but are not aristocrats in the literal sense. And I think that difference does matter. But I don't think Americans are as uncomfortable with wealth, particularly, or inherited wealth, particularly because Trump's narrative is very interesting. I think Trump's onto something. So the New York Times makes it quite clear. I mean, I think the figure, the aggregate figure that Fred Trump gave to Donald over the course of his lifetime was $413 million. Well, that's a pretty good start in life.
In 2018 dollars.
Yes. That's right. But what Trump – if Trump has a genius, it's as he comes from another American tradition, which is the confidence man, in the sense that he has managed – I think he has created himself – he's created an image for himself as a self-made man, and he did so using popular culture. So he did so on The Apprentice. He's done so with a lot of his more grandiose and public activities in his buildings and Trump Casino and all this kind of stuff. And so he's fostered this self-made man image incredibly powerfully and incredibly effectively, in fact, parlayed it into the White House. So and in so doing, he was able to do so because of the wealth he got from his dad. There's no question about that. But he used it in such a way. You know, his siblings are also very rich, but his siblings didn't have this kind of public profile that Donald has because they weren't interested in doing that. And there are many, many other rich people in the United States who've inherited wealth rather quietly, most of whom none of us have ever heard of. But Donald Trump used his wealth to parlay it into fame and then political power in a way that has made him self-created, if you follow me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, there is something, I think, though, about this idea of inherited wealth that Americans have wrestled with at various points in time, about how one, you know, reconciles, you know, vast amounts of inherited wealth with, you know, ideas about the equality of citizens, and if all men are created equal, what does that mean when some people are vastly wealthier than others? And I think that those, there are ideas in there that people have wrestled with. I mean, during the Progressive Era, for instance, you know, there was a vast accumulation of wealth in the hands of a very small number of people, at the same time that there was very widespread poverty. And one of the ways in which the progressives sought to remedy that disparity was through creating an estate tax in 1916, which sought to, limit to some degree the, extent to which generationally you have the reinscribing these inequalities in wealth and power. And what's basically happened since 1916, when this estate tax is established, is first wealthy people found ways around it. And I think one of the things that this Times article demonstrates is how effectively the Trump family was able to circumvent the various inheritance laws that were supposed to prevent people from passing money on to their children without the tax man taking his cut. But wealthy people, I think, have also been a very effective at persuading non-wealthy people that the estate tax was somehow unfair. There's this whole move in the early 2000s under the George W. Bush administration to repeal the estate tax, and eventually it does get repealed on repealed actually in 2001 gradually on the grounds that it was a death tax, and they rebranded it as a death tax when in fact it only applied to a very, very small percentage of the very wealthiest Americans. That's gone along with a simultaneous gutting of the IRS, which has been underfunded for many, many years, and they have done relatively few audits of estates, in part because estate planning is complicated. The kinds of audit you'd have to do is extraordinarily complicated, and unpicking these ways that sort of loopholes and tricks that the wealthy and their financial planners have been using is very hard. And so we've got a situation here in which, there are large, the Trump family doesn't seem to be paying very much taxes on anything, and having an enormous amount of wealth, and people who are lower down on the food chain, are suffering the consequences of that, both in terms of, they are paying income taxes and property taxes and other things, and they are not receiving the kinds of benefits in terms of government services that they should be receiving from the money that the Trump family is not paying in taxes, and other wealthy people. So I think we've got a, situation now and over the past 50 years that is really, there's a way you can think that the Times described it as fraud. You could also describe it as theft.
Yeah, I
Where
was one thing that struck me was I thought, geez, why did Trump need to usher through that massive tax cut through Congress last year? The rich already aren't paying taxes if this reporting is correct. So what difference does it make? But it seems unnecessary and gratuitous.
No, I think you're right about that. And I think that's a problem. The top marginal tax rate right now is as low as it's been in really in the modern era. But you put that alongside all the mechanisms that the wealthy have to not even pay that rate, plus the lax enforcement by the IRS because the IRS has been underfunded. I think you end up with a situation in which, the government is tacitly approving wealthy people not playing by the same rules that everybody else does, which I find deeply problematic, to say the least.
What do you
What
think? Sorry, David, go ahead.
I was wondering what you thought the political consequences, if any, are going to be of this New York Times article.
I was just about to ask you the same thing.
Okay.
It's unclear to me. First of all, it's long, it's detailed, it's complex. And those are all characteristics which do not appeal in the current kind of news environment. So I don't know. I don't know what impact it will have. Trump dismissed it right away as boring. and untrue. No, well, you laugh, but actually, he's very effective at that kind of thing, you know.
To be
and
sure.
So,
yeah.
So whether you know whether it will resonate or not is with say Obama Trump voters, the mythical 8% of the electorate who voted for both Obama and for President Trump. You know, will it resonate with them? Will it resonate with the people who've been left behind by globalization? Mm. It should, because you know it portrays Trump basically as a criminal plutocrat. But you know, we've known that all along. So
yes.
I'm a little bit skeptical. I think it may matter. In fact, I think it will matter if and when the Democrats again take over the House of Representatives and thus can begin to investigate some of these matters, because I think there's real strong evidence in that piece of criminal wrongdoing. And I think I think you asked politically, I'm not sure it will matter politically. I think it may matter legally, which will then of course have a political consequence for the president.
Yeah. So I think in terms of the legal consequences, I think we're beyond the statute of limitations for criminal prosecution for tax fraud, but we're not beyond the statute of limitations for penalties, so civil penalties being applied. And so there could be, you know, the New York State tax people could potentially go after him, even if the IRS doesn't, which could lead to sort of interesting disclosures about what's on his tax return now and what have you.
And I wonder if we won't see his tax returns, you know, eventually. Well, I think we will eventually.
yes.
And I don't think this kind of illegality stopped when Fred Trump died in 1999 either.
Based on my reading of the Times piece, I would tend to agree with you. Thinking about how this sort of factors down into, you know, the next generation of the Trump family, I think, you know, I would be surprised if Donald Jr. and Eric and Ivanka and maybe even Tiffany and Barron are probably all in the same circumstance where they're getting paychecks for work they're doing as 5-year-olds.
Yeah.
That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. In part because not only that does that sort of conform with the pattern, but I think there's actually a class of super wealthy people that routinely do this kind of thing. And I think it's I don't know, I find it deeply unsettling. Anyway, that's it. On that depressing note, what kind of last drops do we have, Frank, to cheer us up and bring us hope for the future?
Okay, David, I've been missing you, and I thought of you as I was I've been watching something on Netflix, which I just completed, called The Staircase, which will be familiar to some of our listeners, I'm sure. And in brief, The Staircase is a documentary series produced by a French film company about a murder case in your North Carolina.
Yeah.
I had a case surrounding the death of a woman called Kathleen Peterson, and the trial of her husband, Michael Peterson, for her murder. She died in 2001. The trial, I think, was in 2003. He was found guilty in the first trial. He was sentenced to prison. I'm not going to say too much about it in case people haven't finished watching the documentary. He was sentenced to prison, and then the documentary follows the original trial and then the legal machinations that have gone on until last year. It's incredibly compelling. I can strongly recommend it. But I wanted to ask you, and I deliberately didn't read anything about it while I was watching the series because I didn't want to know the outcome. But I wanted to know, as somebody who lived in Durham, North Carolina,
yes,
for a long time, and this is where the Petersons lived.
Yes.
I wanted to hear your view. I don't know whether you've seen the series or not.
I haven't seen the series, but I followed the case, I guess, moderately closely while it was going on. It was hard not to. That the series called The Staircase is called The Staircase because Kathleen Peterson dies after falling down a staircase. Spoiler alert. The question in the trial was whether she was basically pushed down the stairs, hit over the head and fell down the stairs, or whether she just tripped and fell. And Michael Peterson's defense was that she tripped and fell. It was a case that was very gripping because they were a very public family. He was a, you know, a journalist and a novelist and wrote various things. And she was also a very prominent public figure. There was a theory that was at one point floated during the trial, and I don't know whether this makes it into the Netflix French series, but that she was killed when she was knocked over by an owl. Does that make it into the show?
That is not in the series, no.
Oh, okay. There's a whole, if you want to go down a rabbit hole, about whether or not owls regularly attack people, and if so, what kind of evidence would that leave behind? And there was things about marks on her skull and other kinds of things.
Well, they have to account for the fact that she's got lacerations on her skull.
Yes.
And she bled profusely from these, but didn't have any brain damage.
Yes. And so the owl theory postulates that she was at the top of the stairs and an owl had somehow gotten to their house. They live in a forested neighborhood. There are owls around there. I've heard the owls had somehow gotten in and attacked and then somehow managed to escape and leave very little trace. It was an interesting story and a gripping one for a number of years.
Okay.
All right.
Spoiler for our listeners. So if you're going to watch it, stop right now. But David, as somebody who lived there, followed it, but hasn't seen the documentary series.
Yes.
Do you think he did it?
Oh yeah, I 100% think he did it. I 100% think he did it. And I'm trying to remember the details right now, but if I'm remembering correctly, he had a earlier girlfriend or partner of some kind who also fell down a staircase and died under similar circumstances, which struck me as
she was a family friend. There was no romantic linking between them. But he subsequently adopted her, that woman who died in Germany.
Yeah,
they adopted her two daughters, who figure prominently in the series.
Yeah, so you know, having two staircase deaths in one person's life seems to me to be a bit odd. It's been a long time since I've looked at the actual evidence for that case, but I remember thinking that he was profoundly guilty. All right, well, I'll have to take a look at that.
I think he was guilty too, but when you watch the case unfold, particularly the latter episodes when the legal circumstances are quite complicated, you realize the case wasn't as strong as it first appeared.
Hmm.
That's all I'll say. And
okay.
He part of the problem is he's rather charismatic.
Yes.
And the members of his wife's family did not cooperate with the making of the documentary, whereas so you're getting it from his perspective and the perspective of his legal team, and you obviously have to allow for that. But I'd recommend it if you're looking for something to watch on Netflix.
Okay, great. I'll take a look at that. See my
okay, David. What's your last drop?
I'm going to have three last drops, which I realize is a contradiction, but so be it. So I just got back.
That's a flight of whiskey.
That's fine, and you say that like that's a problem.
No.
Okay, so the three things I'm going to endorse. I just got back from Branch, which is a good acronym for the British American 19th Century Historians Conference, which meets every year about this time, which is a really wonderful conference. I think was the 25th anniversary of Branch. It's a wonderful meeting of historians of the Civil War era in the 19th century. And some of it brings historians from across the UK, from across Europe, but also lots of people fly in from the United States. It's one of my favorite conferences because it really does bridge that Atlantic divide very, very well. And I want to endorse it not only because we had a great conference in Cambridge last weekend, but also because a year from now, we're going to have Branch in Edinburgh. So for those people who do 19th century things and want an excuse to come and visit me or Frank, or both of us.
Britain's finest city.
And Britain's finest city, yes, which is probably more of an appeal than seeing either of us. put Branch on your calendar. You know, the call for papers won't come out for a very long time. But so next October, Put that on your list of things to do. The second thing is a more immediate list of things to do. A new exhibit just opened at the National Library of Scotland called Strike for Freedom, It's a collection of documents by Frederick Douglass and his family. And it's documents that were put together by an American collector that are now being put on display. And it's a really interesting selection of documents that lots of people probably haven't seen because they're privately owned, about not only Douglass's life as a tireless worker for black freedom and for black rights after emancipation, but also records from his family, from his sons, from his daughters, looking at the role that they played in this family campaign for equal rights. And so that's going to be going open at the National Library of Scotland on George the Fourth Bridge until February. So drop in. It's free, like everything else, the National Library. It's not a huge exhibit. So for those people who are at Edinburgh, it's something you can do during your lunch break pretty easily. But definitely don't miss it. And the third thing I want to endorse is a small conference that's going to be held here in Edinburgh, organized by our colleague and friend, Professor Robert Mason, on the midterm elections. And it's a conference called Midterms and Mandates, Electoral Reassessments of Presidents and Parties. And so it's a two-day event on the 1st and 2nd of November, so right before the actual midterms this year, trying to put midterm elections into some kind of historical perspective. Some of it's going to be at the National Library of Scotland, and some of it's going to be at IASH, the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities, here at the university. And we'll put links to all these things on the show page so people can book their place at all these events. Till next time, Frank.
Excellent. Cheers, cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.